All right, good to see y'all. Hope you enjoyed your week off. Although Jennifer came up to me and said, I didn't like that whole week off thing. I miss Thursdays. Yeah? Then Thanksgiving, I expect you all here. No. I'll be in Alabama. Don't show up. Jennifer, would you hand these out? Well, this is that chart that I kept talking about that was forthcoming. It's finished. I had some time today to sit down and create that. So, last time we were together, we were talking about Cyrus. I'm going to give you a quick overview just so that we can hit the last couple of details that we left hanging out there. Cyrus was the first great king of Medo-Persia. He was a Persian king. The Persians had conquered the Medes. Babylon was in southern Iraq, northern Iraq, and into Iran was the area of Medo-Persia at the time. And Cyrus was the first great king to conquer both the Medes and the Persians and then conquer Babylon during the time of Daniel. For those of you who haven't been keeping up with this study, just grab the sides of your brain and trust me. Okay, so I'll walk through the chart that you have in front of you in a moment after we kind of clean up the Cyrus thing. Isaiah the prophet, during the time of the Assyrian captivity, 200 years before Cyrus ever came into power, predicted not only that there would be a king that would rise up who would let the children of Israel go back and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, but he named him by name. Cyrus was named in the book of Isaiah 200 years before Cyrus appeared on the stage of history and then did precisely what God said he was going to do. When we read it 2 weeks ago out of Isaiah, one of the most distinguishing characteristics of God talking to Cyrus was that he kept saying, you're going to do these things to prove to my people that I am their God and they are my people, though you do not know me. And you may recall, those of you who were here 4 or 5 weeks ago, that there was a time when Daniel was praying. For 21 days he prayed, and at the end of that, the angel came and spoke to him. And when the angel came and spoke to him, he said, we heard your prayer 21 days ago, but I was withstood by, do you remember who? The prince of Persia, the demonic power that took Cyrus, the great king of Persia. So when you get the big picture, you know that I teach Gestalt theory teaching, which means I hit you with great, big, gigantic concepts, and then we go back and plug in details, and you have a place for the details to go, and that way you get to have multiple aha moments when you go, oh, I get that, it just fit, great, aha. Big concept, 200 years before Cyrus got here, God predicted through Isaiah that Cyrus was going to come. Cyrus did rise up. God did empower Cyrus to conquer all of the Middle East during the time that his people Israel were in captivity in Babylon. God said that Cyrus would conquer Babylon so that he would let his people go. He did exactly that, despite the fact that Cyrus became or was demonically inspired, and that it took breaking the demonic hold that was on Cyrus in order to create the vacuum into which the Prince of Grecia came, and that's Alexander the Great. Most of you who have been here through the whole thing understand that that is all spelled out in the book of Daniel. We're going to look at more of that tonight. Next. Oh, I have a quote here that I was going to read you. Anybody here ever heard of Josephus? Josephus was a Jewish historian. And this is one of the things that he handed down to us that Cyrus himself wrote, which is kind of interesting. It's interesting to see the connection and how the learned Jews understood what Cyrus had done in ancient times. Josephus wrote that throughout all his dominion, Cyrus wrote, quote, God Almighty has appointed me to be king of the habitable earth. He indeed foretold my name by the prophets that I should build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in the country of Judea. Josephus goes on to say that when Cyrus had read the words of the prophet Isaiah, he called for the most eminent Jews in Babylon and said to them that he gave them leave to go back to their own country and to rebuild their city Jerusalem and their temple to God. Cyrus, a Persian king, had the learned Jews come to him and say, our prophet 200 years ago predicted that you'd come here and predicted you would conquer Babylon and named you by name. Here's the book. And it was when Cyrus read it in the book that he actually did it. Historians to this day are completely befuddled to try to explain how it is or why it is that a completely heathen king would conquer a nation and then let the slaves go. It's unheard of anywhere else in human history that you can find a king who went in and conquered, and having conquered his enemies, he let the slaves go. Let them go back to their country to rebuild their temple and their city and worship their God. You can't find a parallel to that anywhere in human history, but it was predicted by Isaiah 200 years before it happened because our God is, in fact, in control of human history. So that kind of cleans up some of the Cyrus stuff that we left dangling. Turn to 2 Chronicles 36, and someone else turn to Ezra 1, 1 through 8, and this will kind of finish our Cyrus history, and then we'll walk through the chart, and then we're going to go to Daniel 7, fill in some more blanks in the chart. I was hoping to get into a little bit of kingdom language tonight. We may or may not get there. It all depends on how long it takes us to get through Daniel 7. Okay? Tom, you've got 2 Chronicles 36, 22, and 23, right? 2 Chronicles 36, verses 22 and 23.
In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm, and to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdom of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judea. Any one of his people among you, may the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up.
Now get the picture. Isaiah, 200 years before the fact, says that this king Cyrus is going to rise up and let you go back and rebuild your temple. Jeremiah, before the fact, comes in and says that the children of Israel are going to be 70 years in bondage. 65 years into that bondage, Daniel rises up, reads Jeremiah, and says, hey, the 70 years are nearly up. We're going to get to go back. Sure enough, the handwriting comes on the wall during the Feast of Belshazzar and writes, many, many, tekel upharsin. He says, you've been weighed in the balances, you've been judged by God, and here come the Persians. And at the very time the hand was writing on the wall, in sweeps the armies of the Persians underneath the wall of Babylon. In that night they conquer. Belshazzar is dead in that night and uprises the kingdom of the Medo-Persians in Babylon. And exactly on time, 70 years to the date, the first great king says, why don't you guys go back and build your temple? And God had continued to predict all of this. And it's written in Jeremiah, and it's written in Isaiah, and it's in the Chronicles of the Kings. This is such a huge event in the history of Israel that they go back and cite it several times in Scripture so that people understand how God worked in the heart of heathen kings to protect his people. And as I keep saying, by the way, if God will move whole nations around like checkers to protect his people, he can handle your electric bill. You're going to be okay. Ezra 1, 1 through 8. Somebody got that?
In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, said. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judea. Every one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judea and build the temple of the Lord. The God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and the people of any place where survivors may now be living, are to provide him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings to the temple of God in Jerusalem.
And do you hear what he just did? The king just said, anybody who wants to, of the slaves, can go back to Jerusalem now and rebuild the temple, and we're going to give you silver and gold. We're going to give you the wood to do it. He even ended up providing an army to protect them on their way down there to do the job. This is a heathen king dealing with slaves. This is how sovereign our God is. It's quite remarkable. Keep reading through verse 8.
Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem.
Now, by the way, notice that right there. That it is not a completely random thing where random people decided we'll go back. Who went back? The people who God moved. The people whose heart God moved to go back. God always takes credit for the things God does. Keep going.
All their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold and with goods and livestock and with valuable gifts. In addition to all...
Now, think about that for a minute. It says that all their neighbors gave them livestock and silver and goods and gold... The slaves! They said, yeah, here, what do you need? Livestock, goods, gold, here you go. Now, goodbye. Take all the livestock and the goods and the gold, goodbye. Go back and build your temple. See ya. How does this happen? And yet, every secular historian agrees it happened. Nobody disagrees with this in secular history. Everyone knows it happened. It's an event in human history that historians just scratch their head over and go, yeah, it's true. The Israelites were in bondage in Babylon, and then Cyrus conquered, and then he let them go. And they went back and rebuilt the temple of God in Jerusalem with all this gold and wood and silver and everything that they got from the Babylonians and the Medo-Persians. There you go. See you. Goodbye. Go take care of your God. You know, a couple weeks later, everybody in Babylon was looking at each other going, what did we just do? Did we just let them? Did they just? Go through verse 8.
Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God.
Okay, now, do you remember which items those are?
Yeah.
Remember the history of those items?
Belshazzar or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. God's very protective of those items. That's the stuff. When Nebuchadnezzar came down and conquered Jerusalem, he knew that there was a lot of gold furniture, gold cups, gold tables, gold stuff that was in the temple. So he routed the temple and he took all that furniture and he made it part of his treasury. Not only did Cyrus let them go back, but he opened the treasury and said, okay, all that gold, all that great wealth that used to be in your temple, you can take that back. Because it was the very same gold stuff that Belshazzar, the night that he was destroyed by God, had taken out. He was drinking with all his captains and all his princes and all his concubines and all his whores and all his queens. He lined them all up and he said, let's drink out of the cups of the temple that was dedicated to God. All the stuff that had been dedicated as holy to God that could only be used in the worship of God. They said, let's have a drunken bacchanalia with it. And as they were drinking out of the cup, it says that's when the hand of God came and wrote their judgment on the wall behind them and inswept the Medo-Persians. And then they, Medo-Persians, say, you know all that stuff that God judged Nebuchadnezzar? Why don't you take this? You know, you can have all that. So they didn't even have to go back and rebuild the furniture. They took it all back with them. It's remarkable. Keep going.
Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridates, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, what's that? The prince of Judah.
Yep, counted it all out. That means that they had a record of everything they took, and they went back and went through the record and gave them back everything they had taken. To the slaves. Here, you can have back everything we took from you. Doesn't happen anywhere. Yes, ma'am.
The last three or four words, his name, the prince of Judah, were they still having a king during the time that they were captives?
All the prince means in that case is somebody who is the head of a family or a captain over the people. Judah never got rid of the tribal affiliations that they had. Judah remained Judah and Benjamin. The Levites remained Levites. And there were always heads of families and heads of tribes, always. So when it came time to say, okay, we're going to give you back your stuff, they would, of course, send their representatives, the head of their families, who would have been called princes. That's just a translation. It doesn't mean prince with any kind of crown or power or authority. It just means head of a tribe. So are you getting a feel for this whole Cyrus thing yet? It's a very important event in Old Testament Bible history, and it's going to come up in our chart here. So I think we've tied up the loose ends. Take a look at the chart I've put in front of you. For you folks listening on the internet, Mike will put this up on the internet in a downloadable form that you can print out. And Mike will have to help me with the numbers. So in September, Mike, we had like 20,000 hits. 20,000. In October, we had how many?
23,494.
Nearly 24,000 hits for the month of October. And individual users last month, for the first time, we cracked 1,000 individual users in a month on the website. And we hit what this month? 1,200?
1,290.
1,290, almost 1,300 people. Every month that the number keeps going up, I keep thinking, well, we've peaked. Every month, more and more and more keep coming. It's great. So for you folks on the website listening, we'll make this chart available to you. The first column of the chart is historic kingdoms. The very first week that we met here to start studying eschatology, I wrote these kingdoms on the board. I told you that history records six kingdoms that have ever ruled over Israel, that have ever dominated Israel, starting with the Egyptian captivity, which of course happened during the time of Joseph. And then the book of Exodus begins with, there rose up a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, and he brought the Israelites into captivity from that point forward. Abraham had been told in the book of Genesis that his descendants were going to go into a land where they were not known, and they were going to serve as captives and slaves there for 400 years. Sure enough, just like God, 400 years later, he raises up Moses, and Moses takes them out of the Egyptian captivity and brings them back to the land that God promised to Abraham. That's the Egyptian captivity. Because the Israelites didn't keep God's Sabbaths and laws, just like God said, if you follow them, I'll bless you wildly, land of milk and honey, you'll never have any need for anything, and I will protect you from all your enemies. If you don't, I will use your enemies as a way of punishing you. So they brought in the Assyrians. The Assyrian captivity only involved the northern tribes. Now, when I say northern tribes, most of you know, there were 12 tribes in Israel. There are 12 progenitors or 12 sons of Jacob whose name was changed to Israel. Three of those sons, Judah, the tribe out of which Jesus came, Benjamin, the youngest of the brothers, and Levi was the tribe that God set aside to himself and said that Levi would have no inheritance in the land of Israel, but that the Levites would serve always in the temple and always serve before God. The Levites were the ones who got the tithes. The Levites were the ones who were provided for through the temple and through the offerings of everybody in Israel. Benjamin, Judah, and Levi make up what's called the southern kingdom. The other 10 tribes total, because Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, each became a tribe unto themselves, so they become 13 total tribes by the time you see the division of Ephraim and Manasseh. The other 10 tribes become the northern kingdom. The Assyrian captivity only involved the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom were brought into Assyria, and later when they were allowed to return to their land, the Assyrians had completely taken over the land of Canaan. They had put their own people in there. There were already Assyrians living in the area, so they were never able to reoccupy. The northern kingdom never came back and reoccupied Canaan. As a result, they became marauding tribes through Middle Europe, north up into the Caucasus Mountains. They sort of disappear into biblical history, and that's why they're called the Lost Tribes. And so whenever you hear folks talk about the Bible and Old Testament, they'll say, the Lost Tribes. When they say Lost Tribes, that's what they're talking about. The 10 northern tribes who went into Assyria, who never came back and occupied Canaan. That's the Assyrian captivity. The third captivity was the Babylonish captivity. That had to do with not only the northern tribes who were already in Assyria when Babylon conquered Assyria, but now the southern tribes as well were taken out in two waves under Nebuchadnezzar. That's what we were just talking about. Nebuchadnezzar conquered first all the high and mighty and people like Daniel and took over the temple. And then they came back in a second wave and took all the common people. The fourth kingdom that ever conquered was, of course, Medo-Persia, who we just talked about. Cyrus the Persian king and Darius the Mede, the king of the Median Empire. That was the time of Cyrus coming up and letting the people come back. The southern kingdom rebuild their temple. By now, the northern kingdom has become scattered and essentially lost to biblical history, but not lost to secular history, I will point out. And we're going to continue to trace those people. And before these Thursday nights are over, I'll also show you where those folks went. There, that'll give you something to hang on to. The next kingdom that conquered that area of the world was the Grecian kingdom. Every one of these kingdoms, by the way, are named by name in the book of Daniel before they ever hit the stage of human history. Daniel was alive during the time of the Babylonian Empire, and he was alive during the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire, and yet he's going to talk about the Grecian Empire, which hadn't even come onto the stage of history yet. That's what we're going to look at tonight. We're going to plug that in. The next kingdom that conquered that area was Rome. That was the kingdom that was in control when Jesus walked the planet. Rome had completely conquered the Middle East and was dominating Jerusalem at that point when Jesus was walking and talking. The next kingdom in Daniel's list of kingdoms is a kingdom that hasn't arrived on planet Earth yet. We haven't seen it. That's why I'm calling it the Antichrist kingdom. It's the kingdom of the little horn, the Antichrist, the man who understands dark sentences. There's a great deal of names given to him, Antichrist being the most popular, so I used Antichrist. And then, of course, during the time of Antichrist, that's when Christ returns to planet Earth to set up his kingdom that shall never fail. That's why I called it the kingdom to come. That's the first list. Now, when we looked at the image in Daniel 2, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, Daniel interpreted the dream, and he said, the head of gold that you saw was you, Nebuchadnezzar. So we know that the head of gold was Babylon. Silver and breast of arms, which is great, two sides, two arms, a perfect image of the Medo-Persian Empire. The brass belly and thighs is the Grecian Empire. We saw the angel interpret all that in Dan 2 for us. The legs of iron are Rome. Perfect that it would be two legs because Rome divided into the Eastern Empire. The capital was moved to Constantinople. Since then, we have not seen another dominant world empire come on the scene of history, but we're going to, and that was the feet and toes of clay that you find in Daniel 7. By the way, and he mentions the 10 toes. The 10s are very important. You know that there are 10 kingdoms that are going to be uprooted by the Antichrist. 3 of them he's going to take by force. The other 7 give him the power. He creates a 10-nation confederacy in the Middle East. And as I've told you over and over again, it's not going to be the European Union. It's going to come out of the Middle East. Watch Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Transjordan, that area of the world. That's where this 10-nation confederacy is coming out of, because it's coming out of the old Seleucid portion of the Greco-Roman Empire. I'll show you that in the weeks to come. And finally, the last kingdom to come is the stone cut without hands. We know that that's the kingdom of Christ that comes during the time of this last world empire, comes down, destroys all the empires, and sets up the empire that'll never end. Then we saw beast kings in Daniel 6. The first of those was a lion with wings that the wings were plucked off of. It stood up and it said that it was given a heart like a man. So we now know that we're no longer, and the angel tells us, that we're no longer dealing with kingdoms. We're dealing with kings in particular in these beasts. So it was a lion with wings. Then there was a bear lifted up higher on one side that had the 3 bones in his mouth. And again, a perfect image of the Medo-Persian Empire, because one side rose up higher than the other. Then there was a leopard with 4 wings and 4 heads. We didn't get into the 4 heads. We're going to tonight. The reason that the leopard has 4 heads is that when Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was not taken over by another great king, demonically inspired king or powerful king. His empire was divided up among his 4 generals. 2 of those generals become what's called the King of the North and the King of the South in the book of Daniel, and next week we're going to look at the battles between them. But we'll get to that. Then it skips Rome for some reason in Daniel 6 and goes straight to the nondescript beast with iron teeth. And it is during the dominion of that nondescript beast that the dominion of the Son of Man starts. So I was asked a couple weeks ago, why was Rome skipped? It's because Rome never had a central king. It had a succession of Caesars. And the Caesars rose and fell and rose and fell, but it never had a central king on par with Cyrus or Nebuchadnezzar or Alexander the Great or Antichrist. It was always just a succession of kings and a senate. So it was a world empire that did conquer and rule in the Middle East, but it didn't have that central king figure. So when the list of kings showed up in Daniel 6, they just jumped right over Rome. Tonight we're going to look at Daniel 7. So you can turn to Daniel 7. And we're going to talk tonight about a ram with 2 horns and a he-goat or a rough goat, depending on your translation, that has a goat with a notable horn. And then keep the chart handy, because when we get to the end of 7, I'll plug in the 4 notable horns at the end of chapter 7 on your chart. It's right now 7:30. Everything I just said was introduction. Doesn't count against my time. No. They never fall for that. I tried everything. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, got the time frame? Nebuchadnezzar had a son. His son had a son. Nabonidus was the ruling king in the area. Nabonidus, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, is out of Babylon at this time. While he's out of Babylon, ruling from one of his palaces out in the desert, out on the oasis, he leaves Belshazzar, his son, in charge. Belshazzar, his son, is the one who decides to have the drunken bacchanalia with all his women. That's when he loses the kingdom, which must have made Dad very happy. Dad had to come home and go, good job there. So glad I made you king. In the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions in his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream and he told the sum of the matters. Verse 2, Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the 4 winds of heaven strove upon a great sea. 4 beasts came up from the sea, and they were diverse from one another. The first beast we saw was like a lion and had eagle's wings, and I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, And it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on his feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like a bear. This is what's in your chart that we just looked at. Like a bear, it was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth of its teeth, and it was said to it, "Arise, devour much flesh." That's the Medo-Persian Empire. After this, I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings like a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth. It devoured, it broke into pieces, it stamped the residue with the feet thereof. It was diverse from all the beasts that came before it, and it had 10 horns. There's that 10 connection again. Horns, by the way, in the Bible always denote power. So in this case, it had 10 kingdoms, 10 different powers that were struggling for dominance. I considered the horns, verse 8, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn there were eyes like a man, and it had a mouth speaking great things. I beheld till the thrones were cast down or set down. The Ancient of Days did sit, that's God, whose garments are white as snow. The hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame, and his wheels were as a burning fire, and a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were open. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the little horn had spoken, I beheld even until the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given unto the burning flame. And as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came on the clouds of heaven and came to where the Ancient of Days did sit, and they brought him near to him. And there was given unto him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people and nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is that which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the vision in my head troubled me. So I came near unto them that stood by, and I asked them the truth of all this. So he said to me, and he made known to me the interpretation of all these things. These great beasts, which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, the one that was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and nails of brass, which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And I wanted to know about the 10 kings which were in his head, or the 10 horns which were in his head, and of the other which came up later, before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints would possess the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth. It shall tread it down and break it into pieces. The 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after those 10. He will be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three of those kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and they shall change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and a times and a dividing of times. All of that should be familiar to you. We read all this 2 weeks ago, and we went through it verse by verse. And you guys familiar with all this? I'm giving you context here. By the way, time, times, and half a times, that's how many?
3.5.
3.5. Well done. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it until the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. All dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations troubled me and my countenance changed in me, and I kept the matter in my heart. Now, he's gone from seven kingdoms that would ever rule on the earth, to the five kingdoms that were in the image, to the four kings that would rule with this demonic power. Now, starting in chapter 8, he's now going to take two of those kingdoms. If you watch the chart, you'll see how it keeps narrowing down. With each new chapter, we're getting a closer and a closer focus. He's now going to talk about two nations and two kings starting in chapter 8. I'm going to tell you now, it's the Medo-Persian Empire and the Grecian Empire, which he's going to tell us. And now we're going to find Alexander the Great in the Bible, which is kind of cool. Chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. I saw in the vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And in the vision I saw it, and I was standing by the river Ulai. Verse 3, then I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before him the river, a ram that had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I'm going to tell you in a moment that the angel's going to interpret for us, but that is a representation of the Medo-Persian Empire, and historically that's exactly how it happened. This is during the time of Belshazzar. The Medo-Persian Empire hasn't conquered yet, but he's saying the next kingdom to come is going to have two notable horns, which are signs of power, and the one that comes up last is going to rise up higher. And that's exactly what happened. Darius the Mede was ruling in that area until Cyrus the Persian conquered both the Persians and the Medes, and he became co-ruler, but he became the more powerful ruler. So history in advance, one more time, was written exactly by Daniel. Verse 4. And I saw the ram as it pushed westward and northward and southward. That's so specific that that verse is one of the reasons that the critics of Daniel try to late date Daniel and say there's no way that he could have known that. There's no way that they could have known that he would have only, the Medo-Persian Empire only expanded three geographic directions. It went westward, it went northward, it went southward, and it never expanded into the east. And yet Daniel said that's exactly the way it would happen. It's one of the reasons that the critics of Daniel say he couldn't have possibly known all this. So that no beast could stand before them, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, and he did according to all his will, and he became great. And as I was considering this ram and the two horns, behold, a he-goat, some of your translations may say a rough goat, came from the west onto the face of the earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had one notable horn between his eyes. One of the things that history and historians have been completely unable to explain is how a young man, the son of Philip of Macedon, could completely conquer the Middle East in his early 30s, and he swept across the Middle East so fast and conquered so quickly that the image here is that his feet didn't even touch the ground. But the short reign of Alexander the Great continues to baffle people, because where other empires would take hundreds of years to develop in the Middle East, he conquered in the matter of 5-6 years. He swept through all the Middle East, and kings fell before him just like that. And what the Bible's about to tell us is, it's because he was demonically inspired. There was a demonic power within him that no king could stand before. The only king that could have stood before him was the demonic power of the Medo-Persian king, which was the very power that was conquered when the angel came and spoke to Daniel. I'm old English now. Came and spoke to Daniel specifically. I was going to just keep going like that didn't happen. Specifically came and spoke to Daniel and said, I'm going to go back and conquer the king of Persia. And when I do, lo, the prince of Grecia comes. Because the vacuum that was created by the conquering of the demonic power that ruled the Middle East left a vacuum into which Alexander the Great swept, completely unstoppable. And historians can't figure out why, but I tell people all the time, you can't understand history if you don't understand your Bible. I've read the secular history books about Alexander the Great. And when it gets to his ability to conquer, they fall all over themselves trying to find words to explain how he could have pulled this off. The Bible says he swept like a goat who never touched the ground. And he had a notable horn between his eyes. So the goat is the Grecian Empire, the notable horn is Alexander the Great, but the angel's going to interpret for us, so that's okay. By the way, here's what had happened at this very moment that he's talking about. Macedonia, which Philip of Macedon had conquered, who was father to Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had moved into his kingship and had begun kind of controlling that area, but wasn't really at that point expanding his empire. Unfortunately, Cyrus Actually, there's a succession of four kings after Cyrus, so it's not Cyrus. There's a succession of four kings, and the fourth of those kings made a critical military error, which is he decided that he would go in and conquer Macedonia. He wanted more area, more land. And once he moved into that area, it stirred up the ire, the anger of Alexander the Great, and began the sweep eastward. As I was considering, behold, a he-goat from the west came up on the face of the earth. He touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. He came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran toward him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with, the old English says, choler. It means great anger. Moved toward him with great anger, and smote the ram, and broke the two horns. It's exactly what happened in history. So that there was no power in the ram to stand before him, because once the kings were defeated, there was no power within the kingdom to fight back. But he cast him down onto the ground, he stamped on him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of the hand of the he-goat. Verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, but when he was strong, that notable great horn was broken. See that? It's precisely what happened in history. How could Daniel have known that? The Medo-Persian Empire hadn't even come yet. This is during the time of Belshazzar, and he says the Medo-Persians who are coming are going to be conquered by Alexander the Great, and when he's at the zenith of his power, that great horn is going to be broken off. And it's exactly what happened in his middle 30s. Alexander the Great died in the swamps outside Babylon. And, of course, you can read multiple different accounts of what he died of. Some people say it was disease. Some people say it was drunkenness. There's all sorts of different theories. But by the time he got to Babylon, the legend is that he sat down and cried because there were no more worlds to conquer. He had accomplished so much by his middle 30s in terms of conquering and make himself king, and then he laid down and died. Why? Because God broke his power. That horn, power, broken off. Now look at the next part. Verse 8. When the he-goat waxed very great, when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it, for that horn, there came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, if you're looking at your chart, you'll see that the next section I had written there was the four notable ones of Daniel 7. The area that was conquered and ruled by Alexander the Great was broken up geographically among his four generals. Those four generals are Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus Nicator, and Ptolemy Lygidae. By the way, all names that I'm glad have fallen out of popular use. Seleucus, quit hitting your brother Ptolemy. And, you know, see, that's not going to fly. Now, I'm going to jump ahead for a moment, as I always do, and tell you that Seleucus Nicator is going to become, in Daniel 11, the king of the north. Ptolemy Lygidae, who controls the area of Egypt, is going to become the king of the south. And through Daniel 11, which we're going to get to next week, there's going to be a series of wars between the two of them. And then Daniel is going to say specifically that it is out of the area of the king of the north, which is the area controlled by Seleucus Nicator, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Transjordan, that area of the Middle East, which is the area that historically Seleucus Nicator controlled, he's going to tell you that's the area that the Antichrist is coming out of. It's just as clear as a bell. Bill Clinton was not raised in the Middle East, so just let that go. Wasn't Ronald Reagan. It's not going to be some good-looking Russian who comes in. Forget all the Left Behind movies you've seen. Forget all that. It's not that. He's going to come up out of the Seleucid portion of the Grecian Empire that Alexander the Great ran. And why people won't read that in their Bible amazes me, because it's there. It's plain as day. But okay, verse 9. Look at this. Actually, let's put 8 and 9 together, and then it'll say exactly what I just said. The he-goat waxed very great. When he was strong, the great horn was broken. For that horn came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. That's right, geographically, they were broken up into four kingdoms under his four generals. And out of one of them, see that? Out of one of those four generals came forth a little horn. There's the Antichrist. Came forward a little horn, which waxed exceedingly great, toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. It waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped on them. Yea, the little horn magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, the place of the sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given to him against the daily sacrifice by reason of the transgression. It cast down the truth to the ground, it practiced, and it prospered. Now, I'm going to take a moment to go through that with you. But you need to know that what we just read out of the book of Daniel is that there's going to be the Medo-Persian Empire, which is going to be conquered by the Grecian Empire. Its leader is Alexander the Great, and when Alexander the Great is at its zenith of his power, he was cut off. That's exactly what happened. And then his empire was divided up among his four generals. That exactly happened. The two leading generals ended up conquering all that area. That's Seleucus and Ptolemy. They ended up conquering the greatest amount of the area. They fight back and forth in the middle of their wars, which I'm going to show you in chapter 11. You're going to see people show up like Cleopatra. And all of that's in Daniel. So we'll get to her next week.
By name?
No, not by name, but I'll show you where she is. And again, she's in there because, and this is again, the critics of Daniel have such a difficult time with him, because all you got to do is line up chapter 11 and then line up history. And you watch it play out. And you go, how could he have known this? These little tiny details about what went on between the king of the north and the king of the south. And then out of the king of the north is going to come the Antichrist. So we know the area of the world, and we know that he's going to be empowered by the last great demonic power on earth. I've told you for several weeks now, the demonic power that drove Alexander the Great is coming back. Said it in the book of Revelation. That power had been, historically, was not during the time of Rome, and would be again, would rise and go into perdition. People don't know all the stuff's in the Bible. People like, you know, they like that Jesus loves me, this I know stuff. But they don't know that, like, there is all this information about history and about the future in advance, and that Daniel was right all the way along. He's going to be right about the rest of it. And that the demonic power that drove Alexander the Great till people couldn't figure out where he got his power ain't done. It's coming back. And people are going, do-de-do-do-do, I got to get to Kmart. And there's important stuff going on. I'm sorry, do-de-do-do-do, I got to get to Kmart. Was that a little... I'm sorry. Okay, I'll tell you where that came from. Okay, that is a paraphrase of the fact that Jesus said that when the end comes and when he comes back in judgment, he said men will be, it will be as the days of Noah, when men will be buying and selling, marrying, given in marriage, going about the everyday stuff of life, he says, and then sudden destruction lands on them. And he said it's the same way that people were going, what? Rain? I don't think so. And then Noah got on the boat, God closed the door, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and everybody died. The day before it rained, people got up and said, well, we got to go to work. People got up and said, we got to arrange marriages. People got up and said, I got to make a living. And none of them, according to Jesus, knew until the first raindrop fell that only Noah was going to make it. And he says, it's going to be the same way when I come back. People are going to be saying, peace, peace, but there will be no peace till the Prince of Peace returns. People will be getting up and buying and selling and trading and marrying and giving a marriage and making plans. We got things to do. And he said, right in the middle of all their plans, sudden destruction. Bang. And people aren't even going to see it coming. Because they're too busy going to Kmart, too busy going about their lives, too busy never having paid attention to the fact that it was in his word to begin with. Verse 13.
Wait.
Yes?
What exactly does it mean when it says that it grew until it reached the host of heavens and through some of the starry hosts of the earth?
One of the primary characteristics that you see in the book of Revelation, we see it more in Ezekiel, you'll see it in Joel, is that this world ruler is not just going to be a world ruler whose warfare is strictly physical. That it's going to also be a spiritual fight. On par with... Turn to chapter 10 of Daniel. Starting at verse 12. Angel speaking to Daniel says, fear not, Daniel. For from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before God, your words were heard, and now I am come for thy words. Verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings, plural, of Persia. And now I am come to make you understand what will befall your people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. Now, what's said right there is that the prince of Persia, who was ruling at the time on planet Earth, that in order for the angel to get to Daniel and answer his question, that it wasn't just a physical battle to get to him, that in fact, as Paul said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers, dominions, spiritual wickedness in high places. And that this battle in the heavenlies that's going on, we don't see it, but it's going on continually. That this angel, in order to get to him, had to fight through the prince of Persia. It's not just a physical fight, it's a spiritual fight. Here, I'll show you the rest of it too. Go down to verse 20. The angel says, then he said unto me, do you know wherefore I have come to you? And now I will return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. That's everything we were just talking about. The angel said, look, I'm going to go back and we're going to conquer the prince of Persia now. And when we conquer the prince of Persia, that's going to open that vacuum and open the door for the prince of Grecia to come in. Names him by name. Which kingdom is going to come and fill up the vacuum? So where it says here that he fights with the saints and that he fights with the powers in the heavens and stuff, it's because he is not strictly a physical human like you or I. He's a human inhabited by a demonic force that is doing war with everything that God intends to do with his people. So you have to think in terms of spiritual warfare and not just physical warfare.
So you're saying that there's battle in heaven now?
Heaven. Got to define that word. Don't think heaven the place where God's throne is. They're the same word, heaven, both in the Hebrew and in the Greek, that is translated as heaven into the English, is the same word that's used for the skies where the birds fly. Those are called the heavenlies. The devil is called the prince of the power of the air. The atmosphere or the heavens around this world are the domain where the devil has the power to act and react. The devil is not in the heaven where God's throne is causing any trouble up there, but he's causing all sorts of trouble in the heavenlies. When Paul said that he knew such a man who had gone to the third heaven, that's because the Greek paradigm of how the heavens were designed was first was the atmosphere where the birds fly and where the clouds are. The second heaven was the area of the stars that we can see, stars and planets was the second heaven. The place where God sits would be the third heaven. So when he said, I knew a man who had been to the third heaven, it doesn't mean that the heaven that God lives in is divided into three tiers. The first heaven is where the birds and the clouds are. The second heavens, if you look up past those, would be where the stars and the moon and the planets are. The third heaven would be where God is. So when you see language that says there was war in the heavens and war in the heavens, it doesn't mean that up where God is there was war. But certainly if you talk about an angel, which we just read, coming from the throne of God down to earth to talk to Daniel, he has to pass through those heavenlies. And that's where the war was taking place. Now, is there war at this very moment? Well, Paul said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and spiritual wickedness in high places. Is there war against the church at this moment on a spiritual level? Yeah, absolutely. Is it a war that we necessarily have the ability to fight? Nope, Christ fought it for us as he did here for Daniel. I'll put it to you this way. Is the devil a defeated foe? Yeah, we would say yes. We know that in the end, Christ is going to bind him. Christ is going to put him in the lake of fire. And he will deceive the nations no more. All of that language is in the Bible. Is the devil alive and active at this moment? Yeah, we'd have to say yeah. You know, snipers and Middle East bombers and planes flying into buildings. We would have to say the devil is pretty active at this moment. Is he under God's hand of dominion? Yeah, absolutely. Is God going to defeat him when he wants to? Yeah, absolutely. Did Christ conquer the only power he had, which was death, when Christ died on the cross? Yeah, absolutely. When Christ resurrected, Paul said that he took away the only power he had over men, which was death. The devil's a defeated foe. Is he active? Yes. See what I'm talking about? So, is there spiritual wickedness in high places doing battle over the souls of men? Yeah, absolutely. Peter would write, after the cross, Peter wrote, the devil goes about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. That's absolutely true. But I like the word may in the middle of that. He's seeking whom he may devour. He can't devour everybody. He can only devour those that God says, yeah, those are yours. Have at it. But is he actively devouring? Yeah. Yeah, planes are flying into buildings and people are blowing themselves up because they think they're going to go get 70 virgins. He's pretty active. So that's the picture here, that when the Antichrist comes, that that war in the heavenlies is going to become the kind of disruptive heavenly war that hasn't happened probably since Satan was cast out of heaven with his angels at the beginning. So, big stuff though, huh? Big ideas to wrap your head around. But see, if Christianity is limited to the notion that God is a bellhop and Christ made salvation a possibility, if humans will just come along and validate the work he already began, then Christianity is reduced to, well, then I get a bigger house and a better car and my life will be improved. My life's pretty groovy, but I'll add Jesus to it as an accoutrement to my already groovy life. Then you haven't begun to understand what Christianity is. Christianity is the devil goes about as a roaring lion seeking to chew you up and spit you out. Jesus said to Peter, to his face, the devil has desired from me to have you that he can sift you like wheat. But then he didn't say, now you have to go fight him. You have to go conquer him. You have to go. He said, but I have prayed for you that your faith will not fail. So he was protected by Christ. But Christ also said, look, the devil came to me personally and said, I'd like to have Peter. Which, if you were the devil, he's the natural choice. He's the one that's always putting his foot in his mouth and saying the wrong thing. He's the only one that Jesus ever called Satan to his face. He said, I'm going to go and I'm going to die at Jerusalem. And Peter said, no. And he turned and said, get behind me, Satan. You don't desire the things of God. So, yeah, if you're the devil, you went, well, now I know who I get. It says in the Old Testament, I get one of them. I know who I get now. So he went and said, can I have Peter? And Jesus said, no. But how scary it had to be when he went to Peter and said, by the way, I've been talking to Satan. And he brought you up. That can't be good. You know, he did. He mentioned me by name. Yeah, you. What did he want? Well, sift you like wheat. By the way, when he got Judas, did he sift Judas like wheat? Yeah. Judas went crazy and hung himself. The rope broke and he fell and his brains were dashed out. Yeah, that was a good sifting. So I think you were asking about verse 11. I'm going to pick up at verse 11 and see if we can get done with this real quick. Yeah. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. That would be Christ. He's going to raise himself up and act as though and show himself that he is God. Jesus says in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of in the book of Daniel, then you know to flee to the wilderness. Book of Revelation says that when he comes, the first thing he's going to do at the 3.5 year mark is that he's going to set up an idol of himself in the temple, showing himself that he is God. So that's what that means. He's going to magnify himself even to the prince of heaven. That's what Antichrist means, by the way. Do you know what Antichrist means? Anti means substitute or replacement. He is the substitute or replacement Christ. He's going to be the Messiah on earth. And since you have a great many Jews out there who don't believe that Jesus was the Christ, they're still waiting for the Messiah to come. So he is the substitute Messiah. He's going to do great miracles. He's going to have two horns like a lamb. He's going to speak like a dragon. So a host was given to him. A whole army is given to him against the daily sacrifice. So that means he's going to bust up the temple. He's going to stop the sacrifices. He's going to cast down the truth to the ground. He's going to practice. Actually, the word there means he's going to be very cunning. And he's going to prosper. Verse 13, then I heard one of the saints speaking. And another saint said unto that certain saint that spoke, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. I'm not going to get into those numbers at the particular moment. There are lots of different versions. You know that in the book of Revelation and in Daniel, he talks about 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,260 days. They all equal 3.5 years. This is the only place that varies from that, where he says from the time that that happens till the sanctuary is cleansed is going to be more than 3.5 years. I don't have a good interpretation for what goes on to make that number longer. And as many people as you read, they all have a different interpretation. Because the Bible doesn't interpret that, it just says these are the facts, then anybody who interprets that for you is speculating. And I'm not big on speculation. What we know for a fact is from the time of the abomination of desolation being set up until the temple is cleansed and the sanctuary is cleansed is going to be 2,300 days. It came to pass when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning of it, behold, there stood before me the appearance of a man. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the river Ulai, which called and said to me, Gabriel, the other angel, make this man to understand the vision. Oh, this would be helpful. Now we're going to have the angel interpret for us. We don't need to interpret. This is great. Verse 17, so he came near to where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell upon my face. And he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be this vision. Did you get that? At the time of the end will be this vision. So for this vision to run to its completeness has to be the time of the end. If it ain't the end, if we're still here and the church is still active and planes are still flying into buildings and the devil's still active and Christ hasn't come back and we haven't seen the eternal kingdom set up, then this vision isn't closed. It's not over yet.
Is that not a direct
repudiation of...
preterism?
To preterism? Absolutely. Yes,
right,
absolutely.
There.
Right. They will tell you that the end was 70 AD and what the end means there is not the end of everything but the end of Judaism. And that's the face that people make when you say that. Exactly. That's it. But again, like I told you, I'm a literalist. I read the Bible for what it actually says. If you do that, it turns out that it fits perfectly with history. It turns out that it's 100% accurate when you line it up with history. There are other forms of interpretation. Spiritualization and preterism fall right into that camp. I don't adhere to those methods of interpretation. For exactly that reason. You bump into stuff like that and you go, well, how do you make that fit? Well, it doesn't. That's why they ignore those verses. So, we got to keep going or we'll never get done here. I don't want to hold your folks late. So he came near to where I stood and he said that the vision would be for the time of the end. Verse 18. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face toward the ground, but he touched me and he set me upright. By the way, I'll believe one of these TV evangelist guys when instead of bopping people on the forehead and they fall down backwards, I'll be impressed when somebody falls down forward and he touches them and they're brought up to their feet. That's when I'll go, now there's a truly spiritual man right there. That's how it always happens in the Bible. God shows up, people fall down on their face, a sign of worship. And then God lifts them up. Humble yourself before the Lord and he will lift you up in due time. Isn't that the paradigm always? Now, as he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, and he touched me, and he set me upright, and he said, behold, I'll make you to know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for the time appointed at the end shall be. The ram that you saw having two horns were the kings of Media and Persia. Remember that he's saying this during the time of Belshazzar. The Medo-Persian Empire had not yet conquered. And he just said it'll be the two kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. History tells us that's Alexander the Great. Now that horn being broken, verse 22, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand out of that nation, but not in his power. See that? They won't have that power. There's a power he has that they're not going to have. When the great horn is broken, that power stops. Four kings come up, the four generals are going to divide up his kingdom, but not in his power. Verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to a full, a king of fierce countenance, understanding dark sentences, shall stand up. Now the inference there, according to many commentators, is that the understanding dark sentences has to do with demonic worship and witchcraft.
Mine says a master of intrigue.
A master of intrigue. Sounds like the title of a book, doesn't it? And his power shall be mighty. Look at verse 24. Did you see this? And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. See, the four generals were under their own power, but they didn't have the power of Alexander the Great. When the Antichrist comes, he'll be powerful, but not in his own power. He'll have an extra power working for him. And he shall destroy, the King James says, he shall destroy wonderfully. Anytime you get those two words crammed together, you know trouble's coming. He shall destroy wonderfully. I have kids, and they have never destroyed anything where I've gone, that's wonderful. Look at you. You are just destroying wonderfully. See if you can't take out the living room. He shall destroy unbelievably. What it means, wonderfully, originally meant something that you would just wonder at.
Pretty cool.
Something that people will just be amazed at. How does he have this ability? How is he able to conquer like this? How did he get 10 kings to hand them their kingdoms? Well, there will be 10 nations. He'll take three by force, the other seven. give him the authority. And he becomes the greatest world leader because, after all, he'll have the whole Middle East where he'll have all the oil. And then all he has to do is just kind of cut off that tap and the whole world war machine slows to a stop. And he conquers wonderfully. He shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the set aside holy people. Verse 25. Through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hands. In other words, he's going to be crafty. He's going to be clever. He's going to be full of deceit. He'll make deals, shake hands, sit at tables, make peace pacts, make deals. Oh, you can go and build your temple. We'll let you rebuild your temple. 3.5 years later, say, nope, no way. Forget the 7-year deal. We're coming in, taking you out, setting up my idol. He'll cause craft to prosper in his hands. He shall magnify himself in his heart. And look at the next line. And by peace, he shall destroy many. That's why Jesus came along later and said, when they say peace, peace, there'll be no peace. When they are crying peace, then comes sudden destruction. Because people foolishly will give up anything for peace. I mean, it doesn't matter how many times we get the Middle Eastern rulers to come over and sit with the rulers of Israel, and you get out on the White House lawn, and they sign yet another peace pact, another deal. What they can't do is make the people in the streets quit bombing each other because the people in the streets hate each other, and you can't make people stop hating by signing a piece of paper. You can't make ancient enemies quit fighting just because two of their leaders say, all right, quit fighting. That's not going to change anything. But if you could bring peace to the Middle East at a time when it looks like World War III is about to break out, when everybody's about to bomb Iraq and Iraq's going to bomb Jerusalem and then the Iran's planes are finally going to fly and it looks like the Middle East is coming. If somebody rose up and said, I got a peace pact that's going to bring peace to the Middle East, the oil's going to flow again, the price of oil's going to come down, economy's going to go up, everybody will say, that guy is a great world leader because we got peace out of it. But there'll be no peace on earth as long as the hearts of men are sinful. There'll be no peace on earth until the Prince of Peace comes back and establishes his kingdom that is based on his authority and rule and lordship. Until then, war. Constant war. We say it and don't even think about it anymore. World War I. World War II. Twice the whole world has gone, let's fight each other. Let's just all fight, break things, and kill people. Because the hearts of men are so dark. So, it says here that he is going to, by peace, destroy many. And he shall also stand up against the prince of princes, that's Christ. But he shall be broken without hand. You see that? No man is going to take him down. He's not going to be stabbed like Caesar. He doesn't have to worry about the Ides of March. He's not going to be destroyed by any man through any subtlety. Christ himself, as we've read time and time again, will come back and destroy him personally. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told are true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted. Yeah, good choice. I, Daniel, fainted, and I was sick for certain days. Afterwards, I rose up, and I did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but nobody understood it. Now, if you follow through the chart, you'll see that I've got the four notable ones, which are the four generals that history tells us broke up Alexander the Great's empire. Seleucus and Ptolemy become the king of the north and the king of the south in Daniel 11. That's where we're going next week. Then in Daniel 11, coming out of the king of the north will be the vile person, the little horn is going to rise up. So if you're seeing anything out of the book of Daniel, I'll say it one more time, the way we've seen it is seven kingdoms that ever conquered the Middle East and ruled over the Middle East, then down to five of those kingdoms starting at Babylon, then four kings, then the ram and the he-goat, two kings, then two of the generals of one of those kings, and then it's going to come down to the Antichrist from there. So if you go through the book of Daniel carefully, like we're doing, and just chart it out, you can know where the Antichrist is coming from. That's the point of the book of Daniel. But it's easier to write sensational books and say, it's going to be some good-looking blonde Swede or something. And it's going to be Ronald Reagan. He's going to get shot in the head, and then he's going to come back to life, and then he'll be the Antichrist. And because they don't know how to interpret these things. When you get to Revelation, as we saw a couple weeks ago, and you see the beast with the seven heads, and one of the heads is wounded unto death, you understand then that these are kingdoms. It's not a guy wounded unto death. It's the seven ancient kingdoms. One of them is not during the time of Rome and will come again. It's the power of Alexander the Great. It'll rule the Antichrist, but not his own power. See how it all kind of fits together now? Any questions about that? Next week we'll go to Daniel 11. I never did get to kingdom language tonight, but we'll get to all that eventually too. And I'll keep preaching this till Jesus comes, because it'll take that long to sort it all out. No questions? All right, good. Take cookies and candy with you, because there's lots of cookies and candy in the back. Thanks for being here, and we'll...